This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Let's get to Dr. Seth Lederman, the CEO and the co-founder of Tonix Pharmaceuticals, also the chairman. He joins us once again on the phone from Massachusetts. Dr. Lederman, it is great to have you back with us. How are you?
Great to be with you again. I'm well. It's a great day to be speaking to you about COVID vaccines.
Yeah, a lot of news when it comes to COVID vaccines. We just heard from President Biden encouraging everybody who has not yet gotten a vaccine to go out there and get it. Do you agree with the president that this continues to be a pandemic of the unvaccinated?
Absolutely. President Biden is a tough act to follow. I thought he had a clear message, and I agree with him that by and large, particularly fueled by the Delta variant, this is a epidemic or pandemic of the unvaccinated in the United States right now.
And so, Dr. Lederman, we heard from President Biden that FDA approval, it's the gold standard. But I'm curious to hear your take that, you know, now that we do have full authorization, it's finally here. Do you think this will actually lead to meaningfully more vaccinations?
Well, I hope so. First of all, I think it's a sign of a great achievement for Pfizer and their partner BioNTech to get their vaccine to this point. And I think many people believe that Moderna is not far behind. We're in an unusual situation where the Surgeon General is tipping his cards on some of these approvals coming up. So I think that the mRNA technology that they developed and rapidly deployed has just shown great promise, and it's a very exciting time. But on the other hand, you know, there's also an announcement by the CDC, FDA, and a bunch of other groups, the White House COVID Task Force, et cetera, that booster shots are going to be recommended and that they're going to be starting on September 20th. So at the same time where this is a great advance and a recognition of what's happened so far, I think there's also been a concession that these vaccines are providing only temporary protection, not durable protection.
Well, talk to us about where you are with the type of protection that you're developing right now at Tonix Pharmaceuticals. What is the vaccine against COVID that you're working on, and what's the latest on the timeline for when it could actually be something that's used on us?
Thank you. We're developing a live virus vaccine, and it's based on a novel platform that we developed. But live virus vaccines are the oldest type of vaccine technology. And even in Operation Warp Speed, there were four pillars of Operation Warp Speed where, you know, one of them was a highly successful RNA vaccines. But the fourth that they never really got to was live virus vaccines. Merck was developing two of them, but then in January of this year, abandoned those programs. So we're developing a live virus vaccine against COVID-19 because traditionally, live virus vaccines have provided durable immunity, meaning years, decades, even lifelong. And when President Biden mentioned some of the great successes in the history of vaccination, he specifically mentioned smallpox, measles, mumps, rubella, and polio. Those are live virus vaccines. So we don't know all of the reasons why live virus vaccines provide such durable immunity, but many people believe it's because they stimulate T-cell immunity and a particular type of T-cell immunity that has this long durability.
So hypothetically speaking, with a live virus vaccine, would a booster shot be needed for that type of vaccine versus, you know, an mRNA-based vaccine?
Well, we won't know for COVID until we get into human trials, but for smallpox, there was no booster required, and measles, mumps, rubella typically is lifelong. So they do last a very long time, but again, it's something that we'll need to figure out.
When is the timeline for human trials?
We expect to be in human trials in the first half of next year. The thing that's holding us back is that it's more difficult to make the high quality of live virus vaccine necessary to do human trials. And that's really the advantage of the mRNA vaccines. Since they are completely synthetic, you can rapidly manufacture them. And again, hats off to Pfizer and BioNTech for what they've done. They've really delivered a solid blow to give us some breathing room with this pandemic, for the vaccinated anyway. But live virus vaccines are harder to develop, but when they're developed, they can be easier to manufacture, easier to store, easier to transport, and typically are one-shot vaccines.
And so, Dr. Letterman, I want to go back to the topic of boosters. And in the notes you sent over, you made the point that, you know, we would be better protected by vaccinating the unvaccinated here in the U.S. and around the world. But I got to ask, what about for those who don't want to get vaccinated? If you assume that there's, you know, a certain percentage of the population that will never willingly take the vaccine, in that situation, what do we do?
Well, it's an excellent question, and it seems to be a hodgepodge of reasons why people are reluctant. Hopefully, as the president said, hopefully the FDA approval will allay some of their concerns. I know at least some of them feel like they don't want to be, the subject of tests or something. I think at this point, as the president said, 200 million Americans have been vaccinated, so I think we're beyond the test stage. But I think that brings up another potential weakness of the mRNA vaccines, that we really don't know whether they block forward transmission. Forward transmission means that if someone is infected, are they able to transmit it to someone else? And for the big vaccine successes that we've had in history, smallpox, for example, it really does block forward transmission. And that was one of the reasons why this concept of herd immunity was so important. But we really don't know for the Delta variant whether vaccinated people will be less infectious.
Yeah, that's certainly what remains to be seen. That's Dr. Seth Lederman, the co-founder, chief executive officer, and chairman of Tonix Pharmaceuticals.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, pregnant women with COVID-19, they are 15 times more likely to die, 14 times more likely to need to be intubated, and 22 times more likely to have preterm birth than those who are uninfected. That's according to a study published this month by JAMA Network Open. Joining us now is Shira Stein, healthcare reporter at Bloomberg Law. She joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Shira, it's great to have you with us. The part that I didn't get to in your story is the fact that fewer than three quarters of pregnant people are vaccinated. Fewer than one quarter, I should say. 76.2% of pregnant people are unvaccinated. Why is that so low?
Yeah, it's a pretty shocking statistic. I think it's really because of the fact that none of the vaccine clinical trials of the three vaccines in the U.S. that are authorized and approved, none of them included pregnant people in their trials. That's pretty common in clinical trials, not to say that it's a good thing, but it's pretty common. And so pregnant people didn't have any data to rely on around safety or efficacy until after the vaccines were publicly available and when people who decided that it was, you know, worth it for them to try it and see how it went until we got more data. And so for months, we didn't have data on how any of these vaccines worked in pregnant people.
And so where do we stand now? Because sure, pregnant people were excluded from the vaccine trials. Sounds like that's pretty common. But do we actually have data now that, you know, the vaccines have been available widely for months now? Have they actually run trials that include pregnant people?
So it's not trials so much as it is like data from what we've seen in the real world. But yes, absolutely. Vaccines are safe and effective for pregnant people. They do not cause miscarriages as there is, or fertility issues as there is the misinformation about that around. And as we saw, as I reported, if you get COVID and you are pregnant, you are in a really, really bad spot if you are unvaccinated.
Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so what I found speaking to doctors across the country in places like Texas and Florida, but also places like Los Angeles and Seattle, Washington, was that they are seeing, in, with this latest surge in cases from Delta, a new trend of pregnant people who are getting really sick, who are needing to be intubated and put on a ventilator, who are having to deliver their babies early, and some who are dying, and some who are having to spend months in the hospital. I mean, it's just really awful. These are largely unvaccinated pregnant individuals, and they're largely young and healthy, age like 18 to 30. So it's pretty shocking to hear this. You know, we've been hearing a lot about kids and COVID in hospitals right now, but this is another problem, is pregnant people and getting COVID.
So, I mean, those are terrifying stories. And I'm curious, I mean, is that because pregnant people are more at risk than a normal unvaccinated person? Or is there any reason to believe that you're more at risk to become more seriously ill if you are also pregnant?
Yeah, so being pregnant tends to suppress one's immune system, so that could be part of it. The doctors that I spoke to think that it's not so much a fact that you are more likely to get COVID if you're pregnant, more so that it's a compounding of factors. You know, your immune system's not as good, you're around a number of people having to go to the doctor. You know, there's a number of factors that could lead to it, and if you do get COVID, then you're more likely to have severe illness.
Based on your reporting, I know you spoke to a lot of people who were vaccinated and weren't vaccinated. What did they give you for the reasons that they ultimately did decide to get vaccinated, who are pregnant, and those holdouts who decided not to?
Yeah, I mean, I actually had a really hard time talking to some of the people who have remained unvaccinated. But what I can say is people are just really nervous because of the lack of information that there was. There are also, the CDC did not recommend that pregnant people get the vaccine until a few weeks ago. Two of the major medical societies for pregnant individuals, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the Society for Maternal and Fetal Medicine, they recommended it about a month ago. So this is just a really recent thing. Some doctors still aren't sure about recommending it to their patients. You know, I've seen stories about people saying, well, I talked to one doctor and my doctor said it was good for me to get, but my sister's doctor said she shouldn't. And so I think there's just a lot of confusion out there. I don't think it's, you know, people being quote-unquote anti-vaxxers so much as it is that they are just genuinely nervous because of the lack of information, because their doctors aren't sure what to tell them.
Yeah, and I think the confusion will continue to persist when it comes to boosters and to what extent, like, you know, if somebody got a shot before they got pregnant, you've got fully vaccinated, do they get a booster, right? That's the question, and I think a question that many people will have moving forward. It is a fantastic piece. It's the reason that it's among the most read in the Bloomberg Terminal right now. It's called Pregnant, Unvaccinated, and Intubated, Doctors Alarmed by Rise. That's Shira Stein, healthcare reporter for Bloomberg Law, joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Katie, I think the question remains, is that, you know, the science continues to change. So the CDC coming out and actually saying that this is helpful, that women need to do this, then that's a very important move there.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
While the bidding war over a maker of airplane wheels and fire detection systems may herald a fresh wave of consolidation in the aerospace sector, so writes Brooke Sutherland, deals and industrials columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. Brooke's story will be featured in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. You can read it now on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. Also joining us is Joel Weber, editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. He's on the remote from Massachusetts. So Joel, the big question is, bigger is better back when it comes to aerospace and aviation?
Well, I've got to be honest, this isn't a space that I watch that closely.
Pun intended?
I'm glad you picked up on it. But that was what kind of jumped out at me from Brooke's story, is like, you know, this isn't a place that we have seen a whole lot of action, and then all of a sudden we have. And it's not everyday companies, right, Brooke? What kind of players are we talking about here?
Sure. So Meggitt makes, they're well known for their wheels, brakes, fire detection systems, things like that. This is sort of a perennial takeover target. It often comes up in M&A speculation, but we've never really seen any deal get this far. And now it has not one, but two suitors. The first is Parker Hannifin, which has been aggressively expanding its aerospace business over the past couple of years, trying to get out of some of its more traditional heavy-duty industrial markets that tend to be a little bit more economically volatile. And the other is TransDigm, which is also an aerospace supplier and has a reputation for being particularly aggressive on pricing when it comes to the parts that it sells and parts and services to airplane makers. And so it's going to be a really interesting bidding war to watch how it plays out. But you're right. I mean, just the fact that we have a bidding war at all is notable for a sector that's been particularly beaten down by COVID.
Yeah, Brooke, I want to talk about that, the timing of this bidding war, because it feels like the industry at large is in a really weird place as we try to emerge from this pandemic.
It is, and it's certainly jarring to look at it right now when you have the headlines of the airlines warning about, you know, not quite seeing the demand they were hoping to see in August, the people canceling bookings or, you know, maybe just not making bookings at all. But at the same time, you know, those in the aerospace sector that weren't in the same position as Boeing, which, you know, was dealing with the 737 MAX crisis, actually their balance sheets looked pretty good. You know, they were able to tap the debt markets when they needed it, but, you know, they're really coming out of this in a pretty strong position financially, and I think they're preparing for the next leg. And, you know, one of the things that's been really interesting is, as bad as this downturn has been for the aerospace sector, we're already starting to talk about getting back to a moment in time where we're not worried about not having enough passengers, but worried about having enough planes. And that's really where the industry was before the pandemic hit. I mean, there was a mad rush by all of the airlines to try to get planes, try to get the capacity so that they could fly passengers where they wanted to go. And, you know, against that backdrop, it does make sense to consolidate. You have, you know, a number of sort of mid-sized players, but you also have a lot of very large players that have been doing a lot of deals, perhaps the most notable being Raytheon, which acquired Rockwell Collins, also merged with Raytheon, the defense contractor. And so as you have other suppliers getting bigger, obviously it's a duopoly as well with Boeing and Airbus, it makes sense to try to be as big as you possibly can be yourself.
Hey, Brooke, when it comes to this industry, the thing is these companies, the airplane, the airlines have to make these orders years and years in advance of when they expect to actually have that, need that capacity. They actually expect to have delivery of those aircraft. What are we hearing from from Airbus and from Boeing right now about the way that airlines are canceling or actually ordering new planes, and when are those going to be delivered, and are they all A320s and 737 MAXs? What about alternative fuels? Take us into it.
Yeah, no, so it's we're starting to see, you know, more actual orders than cancellations, which is a nice positive trend, particularly for Boeing. They've really seen a ton of order activities from the U.S. airlines. That's really been the driver of their purchases to date. There was a massive order from United Airlines for Boeing jets. Southwest also topped up its 737 MAX order. And then Airbus has not seen as many cancellations as Boeing, because they were in the beneficial position of not having one of their planes grounded for nearly 2 years, which meant that the airlines had less flexibility to cancel their orders. And so they're being a lot more aggressive at looking at their production schedule, and they think they can get back above their pre-COVID pace by 2023. So that gets to that point, you know, I was talking about where we're moving toward a future where the airlines are going to be wanting these airplanes that maybe they thought they didn't need a couple months ago, but they will soon find themselves in the position where they do. And the plane makers and their suppliers are really going to have to ramp up capacity relatively quickly to meet that need. And then as you play that out further down the road, everybody is very concerned about the carbon footprint of all aspects of the economy, but particularly air travel. And there's a lot of discussion about, you know, using sustainable aviation fuels or even moving into sort of next generation engine technology. I don't know if we're there yet in terms of, you know, hydrogen or batteries or anything like that for large airplanes, but certainly they want to make as many changes as they can that are realistic right now. And you need money to do that. You need a bigger balance sheet. You need research and development dollars. And so that's another key driver for this consolidation theme.
So what's standing between this mega deal and a finish line, Brooke? Because it's not clear if it's actually going to be a slam dunk or not.
Right. I mean, and it's not price, because both the buyers are offering very attractive valuations. They're above Meggitt's pre-pandemic high. We're talking about, you know, pretty meaty valuations here. So price is not going to be the issue, but it's going to be more down to the UK government, which has been particularly prickly lately about takeovers, especially when they involve key domestic assets that have a link to national security. So Meggitt is also a defense supplier. And this is happening in concert with another takeover of a UK defense supplier, Ultra Electronics. And so it's a difficult backdrop right now to try to do a aerospace and defense takeover in the UK. And so Parker Hannifin has made some pretty strong commitments to the UK government in terms of keeping the headquarters, keeping headcount in engineering and manufacturing flat. They pledged to ramp up R&D spending pretty significantly over the next 5 years, which, you know, those are meaningful commitments, and we haven't heard yet from TransDigm if it's willing to match that or perhaps go a little bit further. But I think that that is the biggest issue in this deal and probably what will determine who ultimately wins this bidding war.
Well, there you have it. Brooke Sutherland, deals and industrials columnist for Bloomberg Opinion, joining us on the phone from New York City. Also with us, Joel Weber, editor at Bloomberg Business Week, on the remote from Massachusetts. You can read Brooke's story. It's featured in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine. You can read it at Bloomberg.com and, of course, at the Bloomberg Terminal. Also go to Bloomberg.com/businessweek.
This is The Big Take, the best of Bloomberg's in-depth original reporting from around the globe.
What we have to make sure we do as the economy recovers is look at the data kind of broken down a bit.
These plants are becoming more and more expensive. You're looking at $15 billion for their entry level.
There have been waves of immigration that have faced a lot of resistance.
There's a lot of color behind the scenes and a great untold story.
How did Bezos really come out on top? As the cover says, Jeff wins. He always seems to win.
The Big Take on Bloomberg Radio.
Today's Big Take, the very best of Bloomberg's in-depth original reporting from around the globe every day, is by Rich Miller, economics reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C. It's all about Fed Chair Jerome Powell's policy revolution and how it was blindsided by the COVID-19 crisis. Rich Miller writes that when Fed Chair Jerome Powell rolled out a new modus operandi for running monetary policy at Jackson Hole a year ago, the economy was just coming out of a pandemic-driven nosedive. That was after a decade of disappointingly slow growth, with inflation stubbornly below target. Well, times have changed, Rich. What was the MO he rolled out a year ago, and where are we now?
Well, I mean, it's as you say, times have changed. We're at an inflation rate, at least by the Fed's measure, which is two times higher than they liked, at 4% instead of 2%. We're at an economy that's growing at rates that we haven't seen for decades, and we've still got a monetary policy setting that's the same as it was a year ago. So that's raising questions about whether the Fed is going to be too slow to try to rein things in, and that we're going to either get, you know, a housing bubble or some sort of financial bubble, or a return of something like we saw in the 1960s with inflation starting to creep higher.
So, Rich, it feels like the Fed is in a tricky spot because, you know, if they wait too long and stick to the framework, they could risk what you just mentioned, that we could enter a multitude of different bubbles. But it feels like it would be difficult to back away from the framework without losing some sort of credibility. So, I mean, what do you expect the Fed to do here? Do you think that they'll stick it out, or do you think that they'll lift probably earlier than they might have wanted to?
It's a tough question, but it is a key question. I think for the first part, they're starting, and we're starting to hear that already, is that their rhetoric is going to start to turn a little more hawkish. I mean, and the aim of that is to keep inflation expectations in check. They seem to be well in check in the Treasury market because we have yields well down from where they were earlier in the year. But consumers seem a little bit more worried, and so they want to keep those. So you're starting to see the rhetoric shift, and I would expect that Chair Powell will give us a little bit of more insight, not too much, but a little more insight into their plans for beginning the taper when he speaks at the end of this week at the virtual. It's a virtual Jackson Hole again this year because of COVID.
Well, I think that's an entirely new story on its own that we learned about late last week, that the fact that the Delta variant is running so rampant that this thing that they thought would be virtual or wouldn't be virtual would be for a second year in a row, Rich, would be virtual. I wonder about the Fed's dual mandate here and to what extent the Fed is willing to let the economy run hot in order to satisfy its other mandate, which is to get maximum employment. Like, how hot is the Fed gonna let the economy run hot?
Well, right now, they're focusing not so much on how high the inflation rate is, but for how long it's going to last, you know, stay there, right? So their story, and this is our story and we're sticking to it, is that, you know, the inflation we're seeing is transitory. So I think, though, that argument may get a little stale as we get into next year. And so that, you know, that may be the time when you might see them getting a little more worried. Or they may turn out to be right and, you know, inflation will settle back down. You know, we've already seen, you know, some, you know, subsiding in inflation on some of the areas like rental car prices that have proven most troublesome. So, but I would think if you're still seeing pretty inflation like 3% or more at the end of this year, they might start getting more worried.
And so, Rich, this is something I think about a lot, and it's kind of impossible to answer, but if the Fed had known this pandemic was coming, if they had known that trillions of dollars of fiscal stimulus were on the way, do you think they would have committed to this new average inflation targeting framework?
I think, well, they were going off what they saw of a history of decades, right, of you know, this whole secular stagnation story of Larry Summers, that, you know, we for decades we've seen low inflation, low interest rates, and slow growth. And, you know, ever since they introduced their inflation target in 2012, they've basically been short. So they were going on that. I think, you know, you could argue that maybe they went a bridge too far in the forward guidance they gave. And when, you know, not only did they have the framework, but they have the forward guidance, and they say, well, we don't expect to raise rates until we hit 2% inflation.
Right. Rich Miller, we're going to have to leave it there. Economics reporter at Bloomberg News joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C. You can read Rich's story and more like it from Bloomberg's The Big Take at Bloomberg.com and, of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. This is Bloomberg Business Week, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
We're driving to the close with just over 10 minutes away from the market close on this Monday, August 23rd, 2021. Stocks in the green. The Dow higher by more than 0.7%. The S&P 500 higher by more than 0.9%. The Nasdaq higher by 1.63%. Let's get right into it with Mitch Rubin, Chief Investment Officer and a Managing Partner at River Park Funds, joining us on the phone from New York City. Mitch, it's great to have you on the show today. Shares of U.S. equities are rallying today on the news that the Pfizer-BioNTech has been approved by U.S. regulators, fully approved. Are you surprised to see an equity market reaction such as this, considering that this was expected?
You know, we're in this strange time where I think people have this large perspective of risk on versus risk off. August is a light trading month, so small amounts of news can move the market. I think right now the biggest thing on people's headlines is, are we going to have another shutdown? And I think the more people think the vaccine is becoming more accepted, then we're more likely to fight back against Delta, and that's positive for the market and for equities and optimism. So it's not surprising to see a decent size move.
Do you think we're going to have another shutdown?
Yeah, I certainly don't think we're going to have a full shutdown. Could we have another spike of COVID that causes people to be worried? Certainly.
I mean, I think the difference now with where we were back in April of 2020, when we were seeing shutdowns, is we know so much more about the virus and the way it's spread and about vaccines. And we also know how to work in an environment that's hybrid, right? An environment that the virus is running rampant, but also one that still requires us to, and many people, to actually physically be in the office.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a society conversation and there's a markets and economy conversation. I think the markets and economy conversation is the virus isn't a particularly important economic event. It's been our reaction to the virus in shutting down certain businesses and what is going to be our change in day-to-day life. And I think what the market is as a forward-looking mechanism is saying, okay, we're beginning to think beyond the virus as disrupting corporate earnings, and how do we think about, you know, what we're willing to pay for stock or for equities for the next few years. I think in the near term, we're all hyper-focused on what does life look like for the next few months and years, and when do we go back to work, and when do we feel safe. And I think that disconnect is troubling a lot of people, because the markets seem quite forward-looking and optimistic, and we're all still anxious and nervous and not quite sure what the new normal looks like for day-to-day life.
And so if we think about, you know, where we are, August is supposed to be a pretty volatile month. You're supposed to see, you know, over the past 5 years, about a 1.6% gain for the S&P 500. But if we think about the August that we've had so far, we've actually seen the VIX move lower. We've seen the S&P outperform, you know, its five-year average. I mean, where does that leave us as we head into September? Have we just stored up volatility, or can we continue to grind higher here, and can that disconnect you're talking about persist?
Yeah, I mean, I think what people, maybe using a slightly broader lens, I think most people are surprised when you tell them, hey, open your eyes for a second. The S&P 500 is up 20% this year, and despite all the conversation about growth and value and different things, you know, growth stocks are up 18.5%, value stocks are up 20% using just some of the large cap indices. Most stocks have done quite well, and the economy in general is strong. Interest rates are low. Earnings have come in very strong. I think if it continues to be the case that businesses do well and interest rates stay low, stocks are reasonably priced. Bonds are not offering much yield. It certainly is our opinion that the market still has an upward bias to it. I think the bigger question as we get it later into the year and into next year is, will the markets begin to have more dispersion? And it won't be just risk on, risk off, but which businesses are prepared for a post-COVID kind of digital-first future and which aren't? And as you get into 2022 and 23, not every company is going to have an earnings growth compared to a shutdown year in 2020. And it's our perspective that stock picking and which businesses you own is going to matter a lot more than do you own equities or are you in cash or bonds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'd love to get into positioning a little bit more and how, you know, you are, you know, orienting your portfolio in this environment. Because if I look at the River Park Long Short Opportunity Fund, you know, I see tech names like Amazon and Microsoft. I also see the iShares Russell 2000 ETF, a small caps ETF. Can you walk me through some of your top holdings?
Yeah, so we run both a large growth fund, which is fully invested in equities all the time. And then we also run a long short fund, which is really a traditional hedge fund, but offered in a mutual fund wrapper. I think what you're referring to in the long short fund is that some of our bigger longs, which definitely include some of those high growth tech stocks, but a good diversified book of other growth businesses and other industries. Some of the indices you're pointing to are some of our short positions. So we hedge out our longs sometimes with market indexes where we think our long book will outperform the market as a whole, but more often with just individual shorts. And so we are short a little bit of the small cap index just as a hedge against our long book. And, you know, the belief we have is that a select group of equities, even though the market's had a good run, are still incredibly well-positioned and reasonably valued for the future. But there are a lot of businesses whose future is less certain as we get post-COVID, and that is a really interesting time to be selective in whether it's a select group of longs and not the whole market, or actually owning a long short
right.
fund, which has the ability to protect capital on the downside.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that and some of the shorts that you like. Peloton shares are actually lower on the day today because of a price cut at Oppenheimer. Why do you say that Peloton is not a sustainable volume of business post-COVID and that it's too expensive?
Yeah, I mean, the way we invest is what do we believe the business has the potential to earn 3, 4, 5 years from now, and how is it valued today? And Peloton is a business, it's a great product. It obviously was in the right place at the right time. But as we look to the future, we don't believe people are regularly replacing their exercise bikes. These are relatively expensive pieces of equipment, generally exercise stay-at-home exercises go in fads, and people buy one thing, and then a few years later they buy another. And Peloton is being priced as if the business they did during the the shutdown was going to be perpetual and growing off that base. Mm. And so we don't necessarily think it's a poor business. We just think at $30 billion of market cap, the level of business they did in 2020 might be the peak level of business they ever do. And if we're right that people either won't replace their bikes regularly over time or they move away from that fad towards another, that the business is just overvalued. Which isn't to say, again, we don't necessarily think they're going to miss the next quarter or whether today's downgrade was right. We just think relative to the things we're long, Peloton is more likely to be lower in market cap 3 years from now than higher.
And Peloton does report later this week.
Yeah, I was just going
to
say.
Yeah, Mitch, really quickly, curious to hear about your thoughts on healthcare. We have just about 20 seconds.
Yeah, I think healthcare, like a lot of other industries, is going through massive innovation. And I think those businesses that are looking to use the combination of data and science in the future to make us all
right.
to treat things earlier, whether it's detecting cancer earlier or doing surgery with
right.
robotics and things like that. We think that's a fascinating place to invest in our businesses that are going to be a lot bigger.
We're going to have to leave it there. Mitch Rubin, Chief Investment Officer and Managing Partner at River Park Funds.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.